You're listening to 89.5 KOPN Columbia. I'm Mike Hagan, and I'll be back with you in a few minutes.
Board signs, winding wheels and telephone wires. The truth is somewhere beyond the county line. Misty mornings and sweet sunsets, and I ain't even started looking yet. There's so much left for me to find. So long, good friend, it's time to go once more. All here's to the highway, city ends in hardwood floors.
KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Good evening to y'all. Good morning, good day, whoever you might be, wherever you might be. Welcome to Radio Orbit. And my name is Mike Hagan. Thanks to all you for listening to the program and supporting KOPN Community Radio right here in mid-Missouri and worldwide on the Internet. I'll be with you for the next, 2 hours and 55 minutes or so. Got a fun show, exciting show coming up for y'all. And we will welcome James Michael Wilkie to the program in just under an hour. Right about midnight, and we'll talk about Egypt and archaeology and the mysteries of the ancients. He's a real interesting guy and someone who's going to be fun to have on the program. So we'll talk with James Michael Wilkie in just a little bit. Before that, let me say thanks. Corey, as always, New Wave Radio Theater, The Count of Monte Cristo this week. Great play and a great story. And once again, Corey putting wonderful stuff on the radio for you. 1 hour before this program every Monday, New Wave Radio Theater with Corey. Check it out again next week, okay? Also, Kelvin and Eric, they do it up before Corey. They have a program that's called Jazz Plus Blues Equals the Giza Plateau. Of course, Tech Radio, the guys talk about technology and the wild trip that that's sending us all on these days. I had an actual phone conversation with the guys from Tech Radio this evening when they were on the air. I called in to talk with them about something they call cloud computing, which I think is very interesting. But at any rate, they do a wonderful program, Tech Radio. That's 6 o'clock on Mondays. And Jeff Wheeler starts it off 3 to 5 p.m. with Uncommon Light. Good music, good talk, good news. And you're hearing it here, Red Hot Radio, on another Monday night. Moon's almost new. And you're listening to it here, 89.5 FM, KOPN, your imagination station. Good to be here with you and a part of it, okay? All right, thanks to everybody who joined in the program last week. Stunning show, Dr. Len Horowitz. Dr. Boyd Graves, Once again, the question comes up. If there was a U.S. federal virus development program that preceded HIV/AIDS, should that program be investigated? Well, there is such a program. There was such a program. It's called the U.S. Special Virus Cancer Program. By now, you know that it's real. You know the program's real, at least. Whether you understand what they did in the program might be another story. But if you listen to this show, you know the U.S. Special Virus Cancer Program was a real program that existed within the U.S. government for some 15 to 16 years between 1962 and 1978. So once again, I ask all of you, my listeners, all of those who are interested in moving forward, you know, the brother and sisterhood of humankind, you know, please demand an investigation into the U.S. Special Virus Cancer Program. It will solve and end HIV/AIDS. Now, there's another group of people that I want to direct that message to with a little bit of a different tone, and those are the local, state, and federal representatives of Missouri, first of all, and then on down the line to the county people and the local people here. If you're a politician who is operating in the state of Missouri, certainly all of the state senators, all the congressional representatives, Mr. Hulsoff, Claire McCaskill, Ed Robb, Kit Bond, Chuck Graham, Jay Nixon, who he's the attorney general, but and I'm forgetting, and I don't know who else I'm forgetting, but all the newspaper people, right? All you freaking fancy journalists out there that won't cover the biggest story in the history of the world, all of you, all right? There's elections coming up, and I can guarantee you one thing. If you're running for office in the state of Missouri and you are not willing to address the U.S. Special Virus Cancer Program, well, you're going to get a heap of shit from me, that's for sure, because I am going to be screaming about it during election time, and I'm going to be all over every one of you, because I've sent each and every one of you registered letters. I've sent you all kinds of information via fax. I've sent all kinds of things via email. Documented evidence, official, original U.S. documents, all right? And not one of you has even responded. And I know why you haven't responded, because you have no courage, and you're actually spineless nematodes of some sort. The point is, it's not going to go away, and I'm not going to go away. And I am going to jump down your throats, you people. You think you've heard it? You haven't heard anything yet. I have just begun to get this thing going, all right? The U.S. Special Virus Cancer Program is responsible for the laboratory creation of HIV. We have the evidence to prove it, okay? We have all kinds of evidence, so much evidence it'll just bury you. So you either decide to tell the truth or go find another job. Go grow tomatoes somewhere, okay? Do something other than be some dumbass politician that will not tell the truth, all right? Because I tell you, I am going to be all over you, and I'm going to make sure that everybody knows that you guys are frauds. I want one person to come to me and tell me that they want to help and tell the truth. My phone number is 573-424-2890. You have to dial 1 if you're outside of central Missouri, all right? And if you're out of this country, well, figure out a way to get a hold of me. Most of you people should be leaving the country. You know what? Because there is going to be a firestorm chasing your asses. You are in such deep crap. You have no idea what's going on. And it is about to crash down on top of you all. Because this thing is going to go supernova. And if you're not ready for it, well, good luck. All right? And I am fed up with every one of your asses. Bunch of lying creeps, cheating freaks, pedophiles, jerks. Attempting to be leaders, trying to pass yourself off as people who actually give a damn about other people. You don't care about anything. Care about your stupid, lousy lobbies and your lousy cash in the back pocket. That's what it comes down to with most of you people. All right? Well, guess what? That's all about to change. And if you don't think so, well, you know, it's a matter of where you place your bets, right? Where you place your bets with all your fancy money. The U.S. Special Virus Cancer Program. Investigate it. It will solve and end HIV/AIDS. Thanks once again to Boyd and Len. Remarkable and courageous work these guys are doing. Incredible. The silence is amazing. Absolutely remarkable that no one we'll talk about this. No one. I'll talk about it. Music last week from Corrado Rossi. Beautiful songs from southern Italy. Glad to share it with y'all. By the way, all the musicians that are featured on the program can be found on the website, okay? Right over in the music archive section. Just go over to Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com, and you can check out the people that play on the program and find links to their websites and download MP3s and all that kind of stuff. Tonight's music actually is from a man whose name is Michael McGinty. I know very little about this man, although I like the music. I met him in a bar like a year and a half ago, and he gave me a copy of his disc, and it's been sitting on a shelf ever since, and I just sort of serendipitously found it again today and decided I'd play it for you. And I went to look him up on the web, and I can't find any information really about him, so I don't know if he has a website, and I don't know if he has, you know, MySpace or any of that stuff. I do have an email address for him that I'll give out a little bit later, but at any rate, Michael McGinty, pretty cool music from Columbia, Missouri, right around here, okay? We'll hear another one from Michael right now, actually. And actually, in a minute, let me tell you one more thing. If you missed the show last week, or any other for that matter, you can download them and hear them from the archives. They're all on the web. Just slip on over to MikeHagan.com again and click to the program archives, right? See what you find, and maybe you share it with others if you think it it's worth it, okay? Once again, tonight, James Michael Wilkie, and we'll have him at the midnight hour, okay? It's Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. James Wilkie at the top of the hour, and now one more from Michael McGinty. This one is called Another World for Darkness. Back in just a few minutes.
Much, much too early in the morning. Be awake with no place to go. Need bright kitchen lights, sting my weary eyes. So I pace in the darkness alone. Down the hall, my little girl is sleeping. Wonder what she dreams up at night. And the sun comes slowly peeking in, casting long shadows with the light. And it's a restless, hungry feeling. Drags me out of bed. Sit down at an empty table. Thoughts of morning spinning in my head.
How about the deepest shade?
That's another one there from Michael McGinty, from a wonderful CD that that he calls Highways, Dead Ends, and Hardwood Floors. We actually heard the title track to open the program, and that there was called Another Word for Darkness. All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Well, what is it? It's the 2nd of June now, 2008. Hello to everybody listening to us this evening on KOPN over the traditional airwaves, live or otherwise. Every Monday we broadcast a show from the wonderful studios here at KOPN, lovely downtown Columbia, Missouri, and we stream the show live as well on the web at kopn.org. Just click on the Listen Live button. You'll get a nice 64K stream from anywhere on the planet, as long as you get a reasonable internet connection, okay? Thanks to everybody who makes that happen for us, all right? Also, all the people that help me out with my own website. We've got Larry, of course, and Clay and Nick all helping out. Big thanks to Chaos and to Nick for the work that they've been doing over the last couple weeks, and I appreciate it. So much going on, it's hard to keep it all together with just one person, but a few friends to help out makes it, man, a whole lot more fun and pleasant for me, certainly. So anyway, thanks you guys for all the help, okay? All right, if you're an artist, send me some of your art, music, poetry, visual art, whatever, and we'll check it out and try to find a place for it up on the website. The forum, where a lot of the people who listen to the program and those who don't, a lot of people who don't, go to the forum and just sort of participate in the discussions that happen there. And we've got bulletin boards for lots of different things, including art. So if you send that stuff to me, we'll find a place for it there, and other people can see it and share it, comment about it, and, whatever. The forum's awesome. There's always lots of interesting things being talked about over there, and I'm always excited to go there in the morning and see what's happened overnight and who posted what, who was up at 3 a.m., and, but people are posting from Europe or whatever, and it's different time zones and stuff. So the thing's active sort of all the time. Of course, probably during the day, during the week in the U.S., the most active times, but the forum's real cool. Now, we also have a live chat that's up every Monday during the program. In fact, the chat room you can use any time during the week as well, but there's always people in there on Monday nights talking and chatting it up a little bit while they listen to the program. So hello to everybody in there, and we'll try to take a peek in there a little bit later in the program and see if anybody has any questions for James. And just say hi, okay? And again, big thanks to Chaos for all the work that he does on the website, okay? Okay, I encourage my guests as well as my listeners to join us in there during the program. It's real fun to have a guest in there with us. All right, my email address, orbitradio@aol.com. That's orbitradio@aol.com. Send me email. You can send an email to me, and I will read it and respond to you. Maybe not immediately. I've been getting a lot of email these days, but I'll get to it, and I'd love to hear from you. The same thing goes for the guests and musicians that appear on the program. Everybody is interested in communication and corresponding with people who are, listening to their words or their music and, trying to get a feel for what other people think about what they're doing. So please feel free to communicate with us, okay? On the web, www.MikeHagan.com. All right, the phone number here at the station is 573-874-5676. And if we open the phone lines later on, that phone number will be 573-443-8255, okay? All right, let's see, 25 minutes after the hour or so. Upcoming guest. It's funny, I haven't done the program, it seems, in quite some time where I've had the first hour sort of open like we have tonight. We've always seemed to be doing interviews right at the beginning of the program, or I've had some recorded things to play, and haven't had a lot of time during the first hour of the program over the last few weeks, and we do tonight, so just sort of take it easy and talk about some of the upcoming programs, play a bunch of music, and just relax a little bit, okay? All right, tonight, James Michael Wilkie, very excited. James was a friend of Kent Stedman's, and I was introduced to James's material many years ago through an outfit that was called Ambilac, and I'm not sure if that was an acronym for something or not. I'll have to ask James about it, but they were a web-based group of researchers that were out of the UK primarily. James lives up in Canada, and we'll speak to him from Winnipeg tonight, but his partners with the Ambilac project, Dr. John Murta, was a South African doctor, and then Howard Middleton Jones, another remarkable investigator and an archaeologist of great stature. So anyway, James was involved with them for a while. They don't particularly work together these days, but it was an interesting background. And all of those men were corresponding with Kent in the early days of cyberspaceorbit.com. So it's going to be fun to talk with James Michael Wilkie tonight. We'll discuss Egypt and the stars and ancient monuments and what it means in regard to current day themes and what's happening on planet Earth, you know, in the now. So that's coming up in just about a half an hour, about 35 minutes, okay? Next week we will have Samir Osmanagic. Samir Osmanagic is a man who investigates archaeology as well. And there is a dig that is happening right now in Bosnia. And about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, there was a discovery that was announced in part of Bosnia where a group of researchers believed that they had found a pyramid complex. And there's been quite a bit of debate of whether this is whether that's the case or whether these are natural formations or whatnot. But my intuition is that they are earthworks, you know, that they actually probably are ancient monuments of some sort. The reason I say that is because they're everywhere. They're all over this planet. And the more you learn about the ancients, our ancestors, and what they did to celebrate their lives and their ideas of the way the world worked was create amazing monuments. The Native American people in this country were mound builders primarily. We live in a section of the country right here in mid-Missouri that is actually overwhelmed with these things. It's just people don't even realize that they're there. They think it's just a hill, you know, or something somewhere. But back hundreds of years ago, these mounds were built with intention and remarkable design, actually. If you look at the layouts of a lot of these things on the ground, oftentimes they represent star patterns that are up in the heavens, and the idea was to reflect that which was above down below. And so this has happened all over the planet. It's obvious in places like Giza because the stuff sticks out of the landscape in the middle of the desert, and you know there's no way to discount it when you see it with your eyes. You realize that something remarkable happened there, and you know you cannot deny the fact that the monument is right there standing in front of you. It's a little bit different when you have forests that have now overgrown on top of the things, and you know, just a millennia or at least hundreds of years of, you know, different landscaping forces which have been working on all these things. And so it's a matter of recognizing things not in their rare form, but recognizing something as common, but just being able to pull it out of the noise. And I think this is the case in Bosnia with these Bosnian pyramid stories. And Samir Osmanagic, and I'll make sure that I'm pronouncing his name correctly by the time I have him on the air, hopefully. I think that's correct, actually. But at any rate, he is an interesting fellow, and he's right in the middle of the investigation there in Bosnia. So we'll talk with him next week about the possibility of another ancient complex in Bosnia, of all places. You know, in the States, Kent and I, years ago, we actually did sort of a formal investigation on the mound builders of North America, and we determined that at least 10,000 of these mounds and mound complexes exist in North America alone. If you go to Wisconsin, I mean, you can't believe what was happening up there. And all of these places are, you know, places of ceremonial ritual and, you know, the enactment of myths and this sort of thing. But there's an amazing legacy on this planet that goes way, way back, that involves pretty much everybody, all cultures, all lineages, and it's a remarkable history that is not being talked about very much. And the things that our ancestors did are just absolutely remarkable. I mean, you cannot go to a place like Giza or Chichen Itza or the Pyramid of the Sun in Mexico, or the city of Palenque, or maybe this place in Bosnia, or the underground or the underwater ruins off the coast of Japan at Yonaguni. You know, you see these things and you realize, well, something different was going on in the past than is being reported in the history books. This is not the work of people who were in any way, shape, or form less than we are. They were more in many cases. Certainly, the most technically advanced architects and builders in the history of the world are the people that built the amazing Peruvian cities, the people that built the pyramids on the Giza Plateau, the people that built the temple at Angkor Wat in Cambodia, you know, the people that built the amazing mounds that are just 120 miles to my east in St. Louis, Missouri, which was called Mound City when the original explorers originally came through this place. They called it Mound City. And, of course, the native name for it is Cahokia. And Cahokia was a sacred and very special place to the Plains Indians. And there were major activities that were centered in Cahokia that involved many, many different tribes and many, many different people of the Native North American groups that that went on there at Cahokia. So anyway, the stuff is all around us, and I think in many ways we're encouraged to not think about that type of stuff. You know, we're encouraged to just go along with the flow and assume that there was nothing remarkable, there's never been anything remarkable before us, and you know, history is essentially just a bunch of ugly, gory, bloody, backsliding side notes up until our reign, which is supposed to be somehow, you know, so wonderful. And I think, well, my God, you know, what have we done that's been so great? The World Trade Center towers, up until 2001, those two towers were considered pretty much to everyone on the planet as the most significant buildings that existed on planet Earth. They were the center of finance and economics, which is what the world runs on these days. Greenbacks, right? Well, guess what happened? A couple of planes flew into those buildings, or something happened to those buildings. Or some people would say that no planes flew in them, for God's sake, at this point. But nobody knows what happened on 9/11 except the people that pulled it off. And all that we know is that we don't know the truth. But regardless, let's just for argument's sake say that two planes did fly into the World Trade Center towers. Right? Well, what happened? They tumbled to the ground. Right? Even if they were brought down by demolition charges or whatever, or if the whole thing was a theater show for some other type of technology. What I'm trying to say is, in a matter of a couple hours, those buildings were rubble. All right? Try this, okay? Take a couple of your fancy planes and fly them into Cheops. Smash your planes into the Great Pyramid on the Giza Plateau and see what happens to the pyramid. See what happens to the planes. All right? That building ain't going anywhere, my friends, okay? It's going to take a whole lot more than some well-placed charges and a couple of, flying pieces of aluminum to take down the Great Pyramid of Egypt. That's why it's been standing there for 6,000 years, maybe 15,000 years. Nobody really knows how long it's been there. But the point is that the greatest of our achievements are nothing but dust, frankly. All of our buildings, all the things that we build that we think are so fancy, they don't last 10 years. Take a house, your house, and, you know, don't change the screens on your windows, and don't change your heat filter, and don't do any maintenance to your house or anything, and I think it'll be rubble in a couple decades. I mean, it won't even be standing, probably, right? It's made out of junk. The houses that they make these days, the buildings that they make them so they can put them up quickly, but they also make them so they can take them down quickly. That's sort of what happened with the World Trade Center, actually. So you can put something else in its place and make another few billion dollars or whatever, or make a big insurance, you know, ripoff. But anyway, the point is that back in the day, all right, these people knew how to build things that lasted. And the way that they went about it is absolute. It'll take any engineer worth his or her salt today and just spin their head right around on their shoulders, because any engineer worth his or her salt when they see what these people have done in some of these places, well, they'll, you know, if they speak the truth, they'll look right at you and say, I have no idea how these people did this. And that's just the fact of the matter. And you'll say the same thing if you ever go to one of these places. Americans don't travel enough. We think everything cool is here, you know? Can't be anything cool outside of the United States, right? Well, let me tell you, there is. And there's some old, old stuff that has some very interesting stories to tell. And a lot of those stories have not been told. Or at least they haven't been told to a lot of people who've been listening. So anyway, that's what we'll do for the next couple of weeks. We'll talk about it tonight with James Michael Wilkie. And we'll do it again with Samir next week. Now, I'm trying to figure out how to get the CD player, so I can play another song in a minute. But before I do that, I will tell you who else is coming up. John Sheliak, Dr. John Sheliak, of course, will be here with us live in the studio the week after next. That'll be the 16th of June. Monday the 16th, John will be here in Columbia for a week or so. So we'll do a live show in the studio here with Dr. John Sheliak, and I'm thrilled about that. That'll be real fun. The 23rd, we're going to leave that date open. It's right after the solstice, and I usually have interesting things to say at that time. So I'm going to take that show and just leave it open and probably spend a few hours just rambling and riffing to you all on my own, okay? On the 30th of June, I'm hoping to get Harvey Arden. He's a Lakota grandfather, a Lakota elder, who's doing important work in Washington and is directly involved with the Leonard Peltier story, which I haven't covered significantly on the program, although I've been involved with it off the air. And we'll talk about Leonard Peltier's story and how and what we can do to get him out of prison. And not just him. There are a lot of people that need to be out of prison. But he's certainly a figurehead of sorts. And if Leonard gets out, trust me, a lot of other people are getting out too. So anyway, we'll talk with Harvey Arden about that and many other things that are relevant to the Native peoples and all peoples, frankly. You know, I'm not really into this whole business of race, and it's what has gotten us into the problems that we're facing with the U.S. Special Virus Cancer Program and eugenics and all this stuff to begin with. It's that people have a tendency to think that they are different and that others that are not like them, whatever that means, however that's defined, you know, are somehow inferior or dangerous or, you know, unacceptable for whatever reason, and then they come up with methods and vectors to mitigate those other people. Well, it turns out that everybody's different. I mean, nobody's the same. I mean, I'm not the same as anybody. If you asked anybody on the street, you say, what do you think I am? And they say, what do you mean, what do you think I am? What do you think I am? Do you think I'm a white guy, black guy, Hispanic, what am I? I say, you're a white guy. And I look at my skin, and I look at my white T-shirt, and I say, I'm not white. My T-shirt is white. I'm not even close to white. I'm some sort of a rose-colored, soft tan or brown, soft brown, certainly sand-colored, I guess, or something like that. And I change color over the year. I get darker in the summertime. And then I get lighter colored in the winter. I don't know if that happens to any of the other people out there. But that happens to me. Even my hair changes color as I get older. My eyes are all messed up. I'm different than everybody. And everybody else is different than me. And same thing goes for quote-unquote black people, right? Well, they're not black. You ever seen the color black? I've never seen a person that's black. I've seen people that are different shades of brown, you know. And in fact, I think pretty much everyone on the planet is a different shade of brown. But I've never seen a black person. I've never seen a white person. I've never seen a yellow person. You know, I've seen just different shades of beige and brown. And we all come from the same roots. We all come from the same spark that somehow launched the adventure of biology on this planet. You know, although there are some people that would have you, you know, cringe at the thought of this. It seems quite apparent that all of us humans come from animals that were around the scene millions of years before we even showed up. We're just the most recent or one of the most recent additions to the evolutionary record. And, you know, we came most likely from primates, from higher apes, from hominids. And That's exactly what we are. I mean, it's all we are. We're monkeys. We're talking monkeys. That's all we are. Talking monkeys with thermonuclear weapons, unfortunately. And we still organize ourselves the way monkeys do. And this is part of the root of the problem, is that the monkey culture that we live in, us talking monkeys, we still organize ourselves in male dominance hierarchies. We still organize ourselves according to, you know, alpha male rules. And essentially that means the biggest, strongest, baddest ass takes control. And he grabs any particular woman or women that he wants as his, and then he assigns his lieutenants. And then eventually those people come up with a bunch of rules and a bunch of silly ideas to make things easier for the alpha males and to keep the system in place. That's what we call culture. Right? Everyone thinks that culture is so wonderful. Well, I'm here to tell you that culture is not wonderful. Culture is not your friend, as my friend Terence used to say. Culture is not your friend. Culture is made to keep you in a ditch, and to keep you in a box, and to keep you from asking any important questions, and to keep things the way they are. That's what a culture is. Look at what a culture is in a laboratory. When a scientist talks about a culture, well, what he means, or what she means, is creating a little environment in a petri dish or something like that where there's only one thing or one type of thing. Anything else is considered an intruder. So if you try to culture a virus, for example, and, you know, our scientist friends are very fond of culturing viruses, well, you have to make sure that your culture is not infected by something else that won't allow your virus to grow the way you want it to, right? So that's the way our culture is. We try to put a wall around it, like a big petri dish, and then keep everybody inside of that petri dish the same, and tell everybody, you know, that we're all Americans, or we're all this, or we're all that. In the meantime, the propagandists are telling everybody that they're different. You know, they want you to believe that we're all Americans, all created equal, right? All that stuff. In the meantime, they tell you, no, you're not equal at all. There are all these different races. There are rich and poor. There are, you know, good and bad, black and white, God and Satan. I mean, it just goes on and on. The whole dualistic concept is brought forward by the same people that are pushing for a uniformitarian state inside the petri dish. And it's a cognitive dissonance situation that arises, and it's no surprise that so many people are confused and hurt and broken. I mean, we live in a culture of broken people. I always mention my friend Chris when he's here with me, because he listens to the program oftentimes, and he's someone who's interested in some of the same things as me. Well, he's in social work. Well, I'll probably just get a nod out of him here, but are there not a lot of broken people around, Chris? Yeah, I got the nod, you see? Well, there are a lot of broken people. And the reason there's a lot of broken people is because they're being raised in a broken culture. But nobody's asking questions about the culture. Nobody's pointing to the root of the problem, right? Well, the root of the problem is we live in a culture that has no interest in anything except material and economic short-term advantages. I mean, it's basically get what you can while you can, and don't worry about anyone else in the meantime. And that has been devastating to the entire planet, not just our country. I mean, it's another virus that has spread around the globe, the virus that tells you that you have to have a 55-inch flat-screen TV, you know, on the wall of your mud hut in Sri Lanka. You know, you don't need anything else. You go work at the factory for 20 hours, and you come home and you watch that big screen for 4 hours, because that's what you're working for. That's why you work there, is get the TV. Anyway, we have a problematic culture, and the root of the culture is, you know, it's poisoned. It's decayed. We need a root canal. And you're going to get a root canal one way or the other. You know, when the root is trashed, something's going to give. And right now in our country, we are in the midst of great change, even though very few people, I think, recognize it. But essentially all of our major institutions, religion, government, business, education, healthcare, what am I missing? I'm sure there are a few that I'm missing. But all of those institutions have now been, I mean, the emperor wears no clothes. All of these institutions have been shown to be essentially, well, incomplete. That's a nice way to put it, I guess. But certainly unsuccessful. You show me one institution on this planet, actually, that has been successful. Well, I can show you one, and that's the Department of War. They've been quite successful, regardless of where they make their shops, you know, whether it's in Washington, D.C., in Hell's Kitchen, at the Pentagon, where admirals get crowned and visiting doctors learn about who knows what, right? That business has been pretty lucrative. But, you know, as I say, nothing lasts forever. Nothing lasts forever, people. It's the fact of the matter, and it's cause for, you know, it's cause for celebration and despair at the same time. But with regard to the situation in the United States of America and politics and media propaganda and misrepresentation of words, constant deception, I can't wait to see this thing be finished. This is not America. We don't live in it. That's just a word now. The word America, my God, people should, you know, they should think twice when they even say it, because the country that we live in doesn't even resemble the country that the founding fathers and mothers came up with, you know, a couple hundred years ago. This is not the same place. So I have no problem seeing all of these institutions go by the wayside. In fact, I'm looking forward to see them all just absolutely collapse in rubble like the World Trade Centers, because they're essentially made out of crap. They're made out of cards. They're built on sand. And they're run by mostly, you know, disingenuous folks with ill intent and with agendas that would make your hair stand on end. I mean, I know that sounds cynical. And I am very cynical when it comes to these institutions. But I'm not a cynic in general. In other words, I think the world's actually going to be fine. And I think that the future is actually quite bright. It's just not bright for those types of people. You know? I mean, that's just my opinion. But that's the way it seems to me. So, anyway, let's play a piece of music here. I'm going to get my guest on the telephone. I meant to talk about some news and stuff. And I do have a couple things I should say real quick. Maybe we'll wait just a couple minutes before a song here. Let's see, who else coming up here on the program? We talked about those people. Announcements. Okay, cyberspaceorbit.com, Ken Stedman's old website. I have officially taken over cyberspaceorbit.com. Now, I'll do my best. It's a tremendous challenge, and it's slow right now. I'm hoping that it will gain momentum. It's just it's very close to my heart, and I want to do it right, and it's actually been psychologically difficult for me, because every time I go there, I, you know, the ghost of the bard is there with me, and for whatever reason, I sometimes just can't pull the trigger. I feel like, remember that scene in the old movie Top Gun where Tom Cruise and he's got his pilot partner, his navigator, whose name was Goose, right? There's Maverick and Goose. Those are the two guys in the plane. Well, Goose gets killed, right, in the movie. And now Tom Cruise, Maverick, has to fly with another guy. And he can't pull the trigger at first. He just can't get it done. He can't get the ghost of Goose off of him. And I'm sort of the same way with Kent right now. And I don't mean it in a bad way. I love him. And he's my grandfather. And I will do this with great respect and honor and pride. I'm just hoping that I can do it right, and I hope that I can get it going and pick up the speed a little bit, because it has been slow, and I've just been reluctant to do certain things. But I'm going to make it my own and try to do my best with it and make Kent proud. So cyberspaceorbit.com, it will slowly but surely become more a part of my business, okay? And I appreciate Kent's family for allowing me to continue his work. The solstice celebration at the Shire, the 21st of June. That's 2 weeks from this coming Saturday. Come to visit us at the Shire in Roachport, Missouri. This is where my family and I live. Once a year, we sort of open the doors and invite anybody who would like to come and visit us and spend some time with us and our friends. And we do that on the summer solstice every year. And this year, it's actually right on the solstice, the 21st of June this year. It's Saturday, and I'd love it if you could come. There'll be details about it on the website, okay? All right, Carl Jung, anniversary of the amazing depth psychologist from Switzerland. Carl Jung passed on the 6th of June, 1961. Here's to you, my grandfather. Wonderful, wonderful work. And I hope all of you out there who are interested in psychiatry and psychology study the work of Dr. Carl Jung. And today, Bo Diddley, legendary rock and roller, one of the founders, actually, Bo Diddley passed away today. So thanks to him for the wonderful music and all to all of our ancestors and all these people that have done such amazing things before us. Aho. Okay. All right, space weather. Not much going on. The sun is very, very quiet. I want to talk with James about the sun, actually, but we'll do that in just a few minutes, okay? Time for a break, and we'll come back and speak with James Michael Wilkie here in just a few minutes at the top of the hour. In the meanwhile, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. This is another one from Michael McGinty, and the song is called Time Goes By. Ain't it the truth?
Remember when we were naive enough to think this boat that we were building, you could never sink? Remember when life was smooth open sea and time was only a sunset drifting underneath? All these days wondering what to say, and all the time gone by. How many years will I wander with these tears for all the time gone by? Falling down, these dusty dirt back roads remind me of you somehow. All these days wondering what to say, and all the time gone by. Well, how many years will I wander with these tears? All the time gone by. Mm-hmm.
listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagen on KOPN 89.5 FM.
And that is the truth. You are listening to Mike Hagen on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And it is just about midnight on the 2nd of June, 2008. And without further delay, I'd like to tell you a little bit about our guest tonight, okay? All right. For 25 years, James Wilkie has worked towards understanding secrets contained in the pyramids at Giza. Through his research and his many travels, he discovered that there were many sources that appeared to be pointing him in a specific direction. It was then through meticulous research that he was able to correlate and analyze these numerous sources of information that brought him to the present conclusions that will be presented this evening. James lives in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, and it is a pleasure to say hello and welcome to the program. Hi, James. Welcome to Radio Orbit.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to be here with you as well. I'm going to ask you to nestle up nice and close to the telephone. You have sort of a soft-spoken voice, and I want to make sure we have a nice tone and a nice volume level for our listeners. But thank you for being on the program, and, well, here we are. We have an interesting sort of connection. This man, whose name was Kent Stedman, who was a very close friend of mine and someone who you knew as well, and you worked pretty closely with him on a number of projects on the website, and... So you and I know a little bit about each other, but I'm certain that many of my listeners are probably unfamiliar with your work, Jim. So if you could take some time and tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and where you come from and, you know, how you got interested in all this stuff and eventually, you know, came to where you are today.
Oh, sure. Well, mostly I spent some time in Egypt, and I still go there probably twice a year now. And the research is trying to find the truth through deciphering all the temples and pyramids that are spread out throughout Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I got interested in that. I don't know why, but it just hit me like a running into a stone wall.
When did you begin going to Egypt? When was the first trip that you made there?
The first trip, after all the studying, was in about 96 or so.
Okay, so 12 years ago or so. All right.
Mm-hmm. But the up to then, I mean, I had I served down in the U.S. In the Marine Corps.
Was that right? U.S. Marine Corps.
Right. Hmm. During, I was sent over to Vietnam there, and as a sniper and that, trained there. But anyway, and I guess somewhere along the line, when I was over in the Middle East, after that, I decided to start following up some of the work and when I actually realized that, you know, all around the world there were these pyramids and, you know, it just intrigued me, so I pursued investigating.
Mm-hmm.
And that led me, of course, to where the major block of pyramids were. And over the last several years, we've been able to now decipher entirely the Giza Plateau. A lot of times, I don't know, in Egypt it's kind of funny. Zahi Hawass, I mean, I might have met with him about five or six times, but...
And Zahi Hawass, for people who aren't familiar.
Who is Zahi Hawass?
Yeah.
Well, when I first met him, he was in charge of pyramids in Egypt. Now he's in charge of antiquities for the entire country.
So that's a step up from where he was when you originally met.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I read a story about him just recently about the uncovering, supposedly, of Cleopatra's tomb. And I'm I have to admit that whenever I see his name at the beginning of an article, I usually make that sort of cringing face. But anyway, please continue.
Yeah, so over the years, I made several discoveries and things over in Egypt. The last one we made in Egypt was a pyramid out in the desert. And I turned that over to Zahi the day before I left Egypt on that trip. I think it was in May or something of last year.
So you have a decent relationship with Dr. Hawass?
Yeah, whenever I usually get to see him the next day. I get when I'm over there and I want to talk to him, I just give him a call and usually go into his office the next day.
Very interesting.
Well, he does a lot of things that like he runs you the same story basically every time. Yeah, I agree with you, and yeah, you should be able to do that. But submit it in writing, and I'll get back to you in 6 months. Yeah, so anyway, I only want to see him when, you know, I have to get into somewhere where it's tourists aren't allowed, usually. There's a lot of security and polices. And
yeah, I remember reading stories and hearing stories from probably not that long ago, maybe 30 years ago or so, where people could still actually get around and sort of walk freely through the monuments and that. But that those days are long gone, apparently, huh?
Yeah, those days ended in about 98, I think.
Oh, so it wasn't all that long ago.
Well, I mean, before they really got tight, they ended up eventually building a wall around the whole Giza Plateau.
Is that right?
But by then, I mean, I'd already been through the entire gambit there, so I was more interested in the other the other temples, and eventually the pyramids led me to temples. And I think we found the first temple ever. And we have a pretty major announcements to make. Well, in the next couple of months, we're working on a documentary now about the all of the pyramids, how they, well, I wouldn't say all, but about 90% of the pyramids in Egypt, and basically explaining that they're, it's just a big map is what it is. And through the use of the obelisks and the pyramids, now, along the way, I was working with Peter Tompkins and Dr. Murta.
Jan Murta.
Yeah. And Peter had already written a book on obelisks in Egypt and around the world.
Yeah, you know, my listeners are probably, some of them, familiar with Peter Tompkins, because I've spoken of him in the past, and he was a remarkable guy. He wrote, but most of my listeners would be familiar with the plant work that he did, Secret Life of Plants and Secrets of the Soil, I think he wrote.
Right.
But he wrote some outrageous books. He wrote a book called The Eunuch and the Virgin, which still to this day is a book that I reach for once in a while when I'm looking for a strange sort of stretch or whatever, but he also did lots of work with regard to Egypt and the pyramids.
Oh, his book's pretty much the standard around the world on for a desktop, or I mean a coffee table book.
What was the title of his Giza book?
Secrets of the Great Pyramid.
Secrets of the Great Pyramid, by Peter Tompkins. Okay.
Correct. And he did another one, like I said, on obelisks. Peter and I worked together and put a couple of CDs out years ago on the history of the Great Pyramid, I guess, mainly. We did other things in the CDs, but anyway, it wasn't until then that I got with Peter that I finally clued into the obelisk situation, that there's two different types. one's giving you a direction to go, the other one when you get there. You know, so anyway, so we've pretty much covered most of Egypt, and like I say, we found a new pyramid. There about a year and a half ago, I guess, and they haven't announced that one. I suppose they'll do like they do all the other times. They'll have a special opening or something, and that'll be 2 years after the fact.
Were you interested in this stuff as a younger man? I mean, how'd you get interested in Egypt to begin with?
I think I was just born that way. who knows? If you believe in past lives, maybe I was back there one time.
Huh. That's very interesting. And you studied it at great length before you actually began to visit the place, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that it's, of course, just the sheer size of them attracts most interest.
Right.
And then it's left there, but I think I broke the first code on there in, 1990 out of the Book of Genesis. We did that one. I worked that one out using AutoCAD to the seventh decimal point. It was the star alignment was called in the Bible. It's called, or in Genesis, it's called the Adam-Seth lineage.
Hmm.
Okay.
Would you expand on that a little bit for us?
Okay. In Genesis, which is written by several people, by the way. It's like a history book.
Right. Genesis has a bibliography. People don't really realize that, but there were books before it, sure.
Yeah. And what happens is everything's sort of hidden in almost a parable-type fashion. But in the Adam-Seth lineage, it was really neat. It just struck me, like, why is this? Why do they keep giving me these three sets of numbers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like the, for instance, I mean, I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but I'll be pretty close. Say, Adam lived, or when Adam was 105 years old, he had a son, Seth.
Mm-hmm.
Adam lived another 600 years or something. Or 400 years, or whatever.
Right. Back then, people were at least according to the books, were living very long lives, 800, 900 years in some cases.
Yeah, but in this case, it's not years that it's really referring to.
Hmm.
And then it'll give you a third number, which is the total lifetime of Adam is 850 years.
Okay, all right. Yeah, this is what I'm thinking of, yeah.
Okay, so
but that's a metaphor you're telling me.
Yes, exactly. Hmm. Now, so all we did was we figured, well, if we equate everything to our mathematics and hold a consistency, then all we have to do is find out the value of one.
Hmm.
So we did that, took the entire lifetime, divided it by 360, and then we found the value of one, and then we found the time of birth. It was 105 years old or something. So we put that into our 360 model.
And why 360?
Well, because everything we know in mathematics is pure, right? So you have to have a consistency. If you're ever going to pass something on, you want to use a set of mathematics that's consistent. You can't. It's not like in physics where you can, you know, take part of this theorem or that and add them all together and get what you want. You know, you need something that's consistent, and mathematics is the only known science that is absolutely, testable.
Mm, okay.
Okay, so anyway, when we drew this out and put it onto AutoCAD and then we did the 3D model.
So, all right, let me clarify just for my own sake, you're getting your the numbers are coming from the book of Genesis with regard to the lineage of Adam, and you're coming up with you're taking those numbers and doing some mathematics on them, and then somehow these translate to a design or a actually a lot of the stuff that I used to look at of your work looks like blueprints type of things, diagrams of the Giza Plateau and this sort of thing. So could you please help us understand how the numbers from the book of Genesis translate to your AutoCAD situation that you're trying to work with?
All right. So we took, let's say we have the, in the Adam-Seth lineage, there's, you know, you go through and there's six names before the system changes. And, like, this will give you degrees, okay, when you're using a 360 model. So in order to keep everything consistent, you just pick a random, say, if you're drawing it on paper, let's say you used a two-inch radius.
Okay.
All right.
And so, and you have a starting point. How do you choose a starting point? Anywhere?
Well, you just put it anywhere.
Just put a point in the middle of the paper. Okay.
Yeah, and then marking, keeping north consistent and east consistent throughout the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
You then, like you say, you put the point down, and you go using zero at as north. You just go around that many degrees, make another point, move your compass point to that point. Again, go back to when you get to Seth and his lifetime, and you do the same thing, same process, using the 360 again, gives you, again, a new location. So what you end up with basically looks, as far as Jared in the Bible, it'll take you around, looks like a big hook almost. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the system changed. And now there's, like I say, there's 6 points prior to this change. And the lineage in the Bible continues on. So we continued on with our set of mathematics. And we finally realized, because on the seventh one, would have ended up to be equal to about 400 and some degrees, which made absolutely no sense. So we went back to the starting point, did a subtracted 360, and then started again.
Okay.
So we have a cycle within a cycle happening, you see?
Okay,
so we draw this out, and then we had a, we built in AutoCAD, we built a precise model, including all the air shafts, chambers, and everything else. Like, it was an exact model of the Great Pyramid itself. So, then, of course, scaling. We just scaled it down and placed it into the into our model. And sure enough, when we fired light beams up the air shafts, and we had found a new air shaft as well, we fired light beams up, we hit all these stars with 100% accuracy to the seventh decimal point, which is pretty amazing, actually.
That's outrageous.
Yeah. So we knew we were on to something, and we went on from there.
All right. Well, let's continue along those lines, because that was the basis and is the basis of your work, is deciphering these relationships between monuments and pyramids and all this stuff. So that was the first of many, many discoveries, right?
Oh, correct. Yes, we went on, and we're able to, like I said, then we got into the understanding that, as we were proving it as we were going, we understood that the book of Genesis wasn't written, definitely not by one person, but probably 20.
Huh.
And therefore, it was sort of a continuing story, or as we find out later, it's a continuing story of the history of mankind. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
From the point of man's creation through to present day, well, through to Joseph, time of Joseph.
As in Joseph, father of Christ, the husband of Mary. Not father of Christ, I guess. I mean, if you want to be technical about it.
But
same Joseph we're talking about.
That's the same Joseph.
Okay.
But now, of course, history repeating itself, or people being named after people and things like this. This it gets a little complicated, and that would take like more than the time we have on the show to, of course, justify all that. But we'll just continue on and accept that for temporarily accept that.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, and the Book of Genesis basically, I think, ends with a line that Joseph requests that when he dies, that his bones be raised. You see, once we reach that point, which is an evolutionary point.
Okay.
Okay, now, so that was all well understood way back then, if this is the case. And we went on to dig up the evidence to prove all of this.
Huh.
The last time I was in Egypt, I think it was in September, I actually located the place where the first tablet that Moses received goes and belongs.
The tablet of Moses from...
No, the Ten Commandments.
Yes, from the mountain.
But only five are commandments. Five are just laws for man. And that happens to fit in a location inside the oldest temple known, the temple at Karnak. And it's a very small temple within the complex at Karnak.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very small. And, they right on the opposite side of, on the exterior, there's a indentation in the wall, a deep one.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like the tablet is actually cut out of there or something. Anyway, and immediately behind it, on the other side of the wall, is a stairway to the roof, which is really strange because this is a very low building and there is no real roof. The only roof is the top of the walls.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty strange anyway. So,
what's the significance of the little section that was taken out on the front part? Is that an indicator of some sort?
Well, I think once it was figured out, it would become obvious because inside... there's three rooms that are actually, there's nothing in this temple except three rooms. They're separated by two walls. There's three entrances into one entrance into each room, and it's from the front of the temple itself. Like, there's three entrances.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the only thing in the walls are indentations. Large cavities cut in, say, the one on the left. If you're looking at the building, there's two of these massive indentations in the wall in that room. The middle room has three indentations in the north wall. They're all in the north wall. There's the first room has two, and they're in the north wall. The second room has three. They're in the center room. In the north wall, and the third one is kind of neat. It's got two indentations in the north wall, and we're talking like 6 feet tall, 2.5 feet wide.
Right, so obviously done with intention.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And but also in that room On the east wall, there were three indentations, and of course with Thoth in between the first and second, and a doorway that leads to some steps, and that just goes straight up to the roof.
Hmm.
That's the entire content of the building.
Mm-hmm.
There wouldn't have been any other room for anything else. You know, it's kind of amazing.
What led you to look at that temple to begin with?
Well, because all the pyramids in Egypt, all the major pyramids in Egypt, now, I must stress Egypt,
mm-hmm.
Point, you can draw lines across apexes to the various periods of evolution of man, okay, but
mm-hmm.
using the same pyramids
mm-hmm.
that all take you to the Temple of Karnak,
uh-huh.
to the front entrance. Absolutely, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so from Karnak, what do you do? Look up?
No, you. It goes into then there's the. You have to understand, like in mythologies, there's always something there that started, you know, the myth, we'll say. But you just have to be able to figure out, you know, what the whole thing is about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right? So it gets down to taking the myth about Osiris and how Seth slayed him and broke them up, cut them up into 14 parts, and scattered them throughout Egypt.
Right, right. James, can I ask you a quick side note question?
Sure.
You mentioned Set, the brother of Horus, is that correct?
The son of Adam.
Son of, yes, but then there's also Set.
Seti the first, yeah.
Right, and are those related?
Well,
I mean, I just see them. I'm just looking at the similarities in the name. That's all.
I can't prove that, mm-hmm. but that would be my best,
mm-hmm.
Based on the knowledge that I have now.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my best guess.
Okay.
My first choice.
All righty.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, the Karnak Temple is. There's an entire wall built around the main temple area. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, inside are many temples. You have, the hearing ear, and, you know, all these different temples. So, eventually, I got around to rebuilding on computer all of these temples to fit them back together as one temple.
Hmm.
Now, in order to do that, we also imported Karnak is right next to Luxor in Egypt. And in Luxor, they have also a pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, the Luxor temple, this you'll find kind of interesting. The Luxor Temple, at its main entrance...
I find all of this interesting.
Okay. Luxor Temple, at its main entrance, had two obelisks, one on each side of the entrance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay? One of each type. Now, when I say type, I mean on the very apexes of an obelisk, there's one of two shapes. They're both pointed, but one is very... very sharply pointed. The other is sort of more a little bit rounded as it becomes pointed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
All right.
So it always takes, from another location, if you're looking across a pointed one, you're looking for the end point, which is in the rounded one. Okay?
Okay.
So the obelisks at Karnak Temple lined earth. Line up to form a midpoint, etc., etc. Anyway, now, so, and also also between the Karnak Temple and the temple in Luxor are rows of sphinxes. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they're only like 10 meters apart. And this is a long way. We're talking, a couple miles anyway. You know, in a roadway, profession way.
Right.
Connecting the two. So basically, we look at it as, like, let's connect the dots. So we pulled in Luxor Temple, and of course, it fit inside the wall attached to the main temple in the specific spot. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So then we had to find out what this was all about, because we had basically put together most of the temple, or Osiris. Okay? We were missing only at that point two or three pieces. Now,
and you mean that in a larger sense? In other words, you were trying to reconstruct the Temple of Osiris using all of these individual parts.
Yes, they all fit together. Like they're like units. If you take a good look at, pull up Karnak Temple and you take a look at any one of the drawings from any temple, and they're measured out and everything, and their shapes and all that, they actually all fit together. All these are little pieces.
Like a puzzle.
Yeah, exactly.
Remarkable.
And so we rebuilt this thing on computer. Forget trying to do it. I don't think we really ever, or anybody ever, has to rebuild this temple. And we sort of believe that this is the first temple because of its age.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that little wee temple inside the first of 10 pylons. A pylon's just huge walls separating sections.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, rather large sections. So anyway, we found all these pieces, and then if you recall in the book of Genesis, it talks about God splitting all the animals in two, and except for the birds,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So now...
Mm-hmm. Hey, I tell you what, James, that's a good place for us to take a little break, okay?
Sure.
We're at the bottom of the hour here, so we'll take about a five-minute break, and then we'll come back and we'll continue with the story of Genesis, okay?
Alrighty.
All right, great. Thanks so much. And, by the way, James' website, I want to make sure that I have the right website linked up. I have right now www.firstborn.ca.
That's correct. That just went up today, so people will be able to follow, because we're going to be dumping a lot of information in the coming next couple weeks.
Okay. And, so people who are listening, if you go to firstborn.ca, you'll see... the front page of the website there, and it is currently under construction, but there's an article that you can read, download, open with a web browser or whatever, that it says click here to download the Chem article, and that'll help you follow along with some of the stuff that we'll be talking about after this sort of intro stuff gets taken care of. James, we've got an hour and a half left to talk, so... I'll let you decide at what point you want to bring in this the new information, okay?
Okay, then.
Okay, hang on, and we'll be back in just a few minutes, okay?
No problem.
Everybody, James Michael Wilkie on the web, www.firstborn.ca. We'll be back with James in just a few minutes here. In the meanwhile, we will hear a piece of music here from Michael McGinty. This is a song called Nightfall, and you are listening to Mike Hagen on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. The program is called Radio Orbit.
Far off distant land, maybe an old worn out pair of shoes. Give me sunshine in my daytime, honey, let my nightmen come to sing my blues. Whoa, the same. it's hard sometimes combining what you feel. Honey, what is real? At least what I have found. It's a hollow wind that blows outside your door, Lord. Oh, when you leave, you're leaving your hometown. Whoa, the sound of the nightfall. Woo, when it's coming down. In this Midwest dawn, it whispers gently out across the plains. And the sun sinks down behind some old Colorado town. And the music, and it begins to change. And you can hear the sound of the nightfall when it's coming down. I'm around a fire burning in New Mexico sand. And there's liberation in my cold, trembling hand. But the longing just grows the longer I'm out on the road. But if you listen close, if you listen close, you can hear the sound of the nightfall. Creeping up and coming down.
Michael McGinty. That is a song that's called Nightfall. You listen to it here on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's Mike Hagan, and it's good to be with you all tonight. My guest is James Michael Wilkie on the web at www.firstborn.ca. And James and I have been talking for the last half an hour about the Giza Plateau, some of the amazing monuments that are there, and a sort of puzzle that he and his mates were deciphering and rebuilding on the computer. James, let's continue again where we left off there.
Right. We were left off where God was cutting the animals in half.
That's right, in Genesis.
Right. But he didn't cut the birds in half. Hmm. Okay, and that's very important. Now, on a little bit up the Nile, and there's one temple, the Temple of Horus, which is represented by a bird, and his partner, the other half, is down in another temple on the other side of Karnak. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, because they're represented as birds, we incorporated them into the temple at Karnak. And
why did you choose to do that?
Why? Because the temple, when it's finished, by the time we finished it, was actually a man, with the interior being like the inside of the body.
I'll be darned. So that's what the final image of the puzzle looked like, was a man.
Only when you bring down the pyramids from Giza, which is the key point, okay, bring them down, put them in place, with the procession ways, you have a man that appears to be walking from an aerial view with the left foot forward, which is the Great Pyramid. The center, which is a straight procession way coming from Bankura, which represents man, okay, in the middle, and then to the right of that, you have the right foot. Are you following?
Yep, and the right foot is represented again by another, by one of the, one of the other pyramids.
By one, by the, by Khepra's Bali temple.
Right.
And procession way.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I mean, it's.
All right. So let's summarize here. So basically, what we have is on the Giza Plateau.
Correct.
Okay, we know we have all kinds of different monuments of one sort or another, temples, pyramids, sphinxes, all this stuff, right?
Correct.
And so you guys were able to essentially, first of all, recognize that it looked like things that were separate on the ground. In other words, a temple here and another temple that was X number of yards or meters or whatever away. They may have been, you got the idea that they might fit together.
Well,
like the pieces of a puzzle, for example.
Here's a mind blower for you. We did more than that. The inside of the Great Pyramid, okay,
mm-hmm,
is equal to the outside.
How so?
Okay, now, you know there's three major pyramids, right?
Yes, there's
Menkaure,
Khafre, and Cheops.
Right.
Okay.
Now, Khafre is actually the Queen's Chamber. Okay.
Uh huh.
Now, how do you make that calculation? Right.
Right.
All right. First off, the most obvious is that it's basically aligned almost absolutely perfectly north-south. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the plateau sits north of Karnak. All right?
Uh-huh.
Now, when you're going into the in the corridor, in the passageway leading to the Queen's Chamber, before you get to it, you've got to step down and then proceed in. You know, you can almost stand up then and walk into the Queen's Chamber.
Okay.
Well, out on the plateau, the only way to get into Khafre, the original entrance, is you're a little ways away from the pyramid, you have to go down the steps, and then proceed into Khafre.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Okay.
Now, one of the other indicators are the offset entrance to the Great Pyramid itself. Okay?
Okay.
It's not set to the center line on the north face, as just about all pyramids in Egypt, well, every pyramid known in Egypt, except for one, is to the north, on the north face.
Okay.
Okay? And as you align these things, it's off by, I don't know, 3-point-some degrees from the center line. And that alignment from that point, as we found out, takes you right across another major pyramid, which is the Bent Pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
Out in Dashur.
Right, that's the one that sides aren't consistent, they're not straight.
Right.
It goes up and then it bends inward toward the apex.
Yes, but oddly enough, that was done on purpose.
I've heard that before. I've heard you guys start, or I've read that from some of your work. Could you talk about that a little bit, or if you have time?
Well, quickly.
Why would that have been done?
Well, because it's used twice. All right, and the pyramid itself, the bottom is, if you work out the mathematics, it actually gives you, say, the longitude. I'm going back 10 years now, so I'm stretching my brain here.
Mm-hmm.
We'll say it gives you the longitude. The top half gives you the precise latitude of the location of the apex of that pyramid. All right?
Amazing.
Yeah. And right beside it, or, you know, a few hundred yards away, is the Red Pyramid. Now, if you take a line and draw it from the Great Pyramid on the plateau across the Bent Pyramid, you eventually end up extending that line, but we'll just take it to that point. And you take a line from Khafre's Pyramid apex and draw it across the Red Pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
Both lines intersect at the apex of another pyramid. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that pyramid is the only pyramid in Egypt that has an entrance on its south side.
Wow.
Okay?
Right, so that's obviously significant.
Yes, that represents Mother Earth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's more to determining that. But
yes, I'm sure.
I can make that statement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in its, because we know this, because outside of Khafre, there used to be a pyramid. It's called the Satellite Pyramid, Khafre Satellite Pyramid. That line from has to cross the apex of that Satellite Pyramid on its way to the Red Pyramid.
So. Right, amazing. Okay.
So all these.
Everything connected, and
correct. So now, we continued on, and we went to all these different markings, because now when you get to Menkaure, it has three satellite queens pyramids.
Okay. Okay, and again, Menkaure is the third of the three on the primary site in the Giza Plateau.
That's correct.
Okay.
And the three pyramids are right on the south side of Menkaure.
Okay.
So drawing lines across the apex of, and across the three pyramids took us to three different locations. You know, would you want to take a guess at this point where two of those went?
Well, I don't know. Maybe Cheops and
No. They take us to, eventually take us to Karnak.
Oh, yeah, okay, back to the temple.
And,
mm-hmm.
And to the pyramid at Hawara, which represents Mother Earth. That,
this is the one with the door on the south side.
That's correct.
Okay.
And it's on the south side because it's the other side of the line, you see.
Mm-hmm. And what about the third?
Well, that was the third pyramid. Oh, the third one?
Yeah. One goes to Karnak, one goes to the pyramid with the entrance on the south side, which is representative of the Mother Earth, and then there's the third.
That's correct. Now, just before we go to the third, underneath that pyramid at Hawara,
mm-hmm.
that's where they know the labyrinth sits. The labyrinth, they believe, has as many as 700 rooms in it.
And this is beneath that pyramid?
Yeah.
Wow. Who's been down? I mean, has it been well explored?
Well, you can't really.
Hard to say.
Because Joseph built, rerouted the Nile, a section of the Nile to the site. So you go inside the pyramid, go down maybe 10 or 12 feet, and there's water, you have your water table there.
Hmm. So,
this thing,
yeah.
This is carved out of solid stone, what's down there.
And there's some 700 rooms, perhaps, who knows what's going on down there.
And yes, that's right. And the entrance is like almost half a mile away, so you can get an idea of the size of
mm-hmm.
that complex could be.
Wow.
We won't tell them where the entrance is, though.
All right.
Anyway, now the third one takes you to the tomb of Abraham.
the tomb of Abraham, as in Abraham, the grandfather of all the three major religions on this planet.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's the significance.
And that, and it's, how do we even know where his tomb is or was or was supposed to be?
Well, because all of the information from the king's chamber, which represents man. And we go there, and everything's the way it's supposed to be. And that's when we were able to definitively say, because remember, Abraham put up a marker, okay, to God.
Hmm.
Well, that marker happens to be a pyramid.
Huh.
And, of course, from that pyramid apex, across the altar of sacrifice, splitting the wells of Abraham and Isaac, take you, and there's one other piece that now exists, takes you to Karnak Temple, main entrance.
Huh. All roads lead to Karnak.
Mm-hmm. The first temple.
Very, very interesting. Now, with regard to the idea of the man, right?
Correct.
Why
is there step pyramids?
That's exactly the question.
Okay. Now, I know you know Lee Major Jenkins.
Yeah, John Major Jenkins, yeah.
John Major.
Yeah, he's a friend of mine and done some really interesting work, I think.
Right. I used to, in my... a few years back now, I didn't want to get into any conflicts with those that follow, you know, the Mayan pyramids,
mm-hmm.
right? But I tried to help them as much as I could without divulging too much information, okay, at that time, because I wasn't 100% sure. Now, the Mayan pyramids basically are step pyramids.
Yeah.
Okay. Usually consisting of probably, what, about five layers? Something like that.
Okay.
It doesn't matter if it's four or five. Anyway, the key point that they keep missing and overlook are the steps leading up to the pyramid.
Hmm.
Leading up the pyramid. This is the equivalent of the Great Pyramid itself. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the Mayans decided to show a different aspect of it. And yes, there are five levels so far in our evolution process.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the steps, if you were to extend those steps so they wrap around the whole building, at the end, you would end up with a pyramid similar to the ones in Egypt.
Right, because we do have step pyramids in Egypt, but they're...
Well, we have one there that the outside's fallen off. And this is a very key one. It's around Matum that has only three levels to it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of this is because the ones in Egypt are closest to the Earth's, more information on the Earth's relative zero point in space. Okay?
Right.
Now, the Mayans couldn't do that there because that information isn't correct. Like the Mayan, in that location.
Oh, because of the geographic situation.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right.
So they chose to show that that wasn't, from their point of view, they couldn't leave that and incorporate that into the whole structure and the whole layout, you see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, basically, they speak of the same thing.
Well, you know, we're going to take a break here in a few minutes, but I want to begin to talk after the break about the sun, and certainly both the Maya and the Egyptian cultures were both very interested in the sun.
And rightfully they should be.
And rightfully so. Okay, let's take the next 5 minutes or so to wrap up this part of the conversation with regard to the historical part of your research. And if you have anything else that's critical for this part of the conversation, maybe you can get it in the next few minutes, and then we'll start talking about the implications of what you guys have found with regard to modern-day situations, current events, etc.
All righty. Now, the other things, is like you said, there's five basic levels, okay,
mm-hmm.
that lead to zero. Zero point being, in this case, the temple at Karnak. Okay?
Yeah, what else?
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the plateau, back to the plateau, this is the point where you begin to make the exact calculations, okay?
Okay.
Now, there were something like 11 pyramids, and like I point out that, you know, you draw lines across certain points, but there are also solar boat holes, right?
Hmm. What's that?
Well, this is where they found these intact and sometimes decayed large solar boats.
What's a solar boat? I wish I had one.
Well,
sounds nice. With the price of gas, I'd like to have a solar boat, I think.
Yeah, except they're just sort of basically made out of wood.
Okay.
And made to float. But anyway, these were rather large. There's actually on the plateau a museum with the one they got out intact.
Why the connection to the sun, though? Why do they call it a solar boat?
Well, because in Egyptian folklore, we'll call it, this was the transportation for the kings or whatever to ascend to heaven, you know, or the netherworld or whatever.
Okay.
Okay. So they were, in theory, although there's was never used as burial chambers to start with, okay, at Giza. So these solar boats were equally meant to show something. Now the solar boats act like from the apex of the Great Pyramid, you must extend the line out right between the two solar boats. Like you're extending this line from north to south, and the solar boats are on the south side. So right between the two, exactly between the two, you extend the line out, and that takes you to Karnak Temple. So now you have one point being the apex, the second point being the point between the markers, which the markers they use were the solar boats, okay? And then you keep going, extending across a third point, all right? And fourth point, and the fifth point takes you to Karnak Temple. Okay, now one of those points happens to be the temple of Horus. Okay?
Okay.
So you have to have these five points. And you have to do this from the same perspective or using the same system from the Queen's Chamber, which is Khafre, across its satellite pyramid. And then Khafre, instead of, you know, I mean, on the fourth level, like these are, when I say there's to the five points, we're talking levels of ascension or growth of, you know, the system that we, our solar system, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, as you extend these out, you can change. Remember I said the Bent Pyramid was used twice?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that takes you down to Karnak. And at Karnak, there's two little obelisks at the main entrance, but just outside the main entrance. And that is the fifth point. Okay?
Okay.
And anyway, all of these things, all these markers, these pyramids, come into play when you, and it accounts for everything on the plateau. As far as pyramids, solar boats, and well, even the Sphinx comes into play too when it comes to end date, end time. Because now we'll jump quickly to the, because we only have a few minutes, to the Sphinx. The Sphinx on December 21st, 2012, at 13 seconds, 18 minutes past the hour of 10 p.m., two stars will come up, well, constellation of Eridanus will be, you know, about exactly 15 degrees above the horizon.
Okay.
At precisely that time, our sun will be 15 degrees below horizon. All right? Now, the constellation Eridanus is referred to as the Nile in the sky. And two of the stars it points to, I mean, the Sphinx, the two paws, point to two of the stars in the Eridanus constellation. One of them being, and this is Rana, or Ra. And in Egyptian mythology, you know, Ra was considered the sun god. Okay? So this is how we can estimate the exact time of this alignment. And December 21st, was really easy because that's the longest, that's the day that those pyramids will cast its longest shadow.
All right, well, good. That's a good place to take another break, okay? And we'll come back and talk about some of the implications, all right?
Sure.
All right, everybody, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My guest is James Michael Wilkie. On the web at www.firstborn.com. .ca. There is a paper there that you can check out, and as we begin our next hour, we'll begin to cover some material that's discussed therein. So anyway, we'll get back to Jim in just a minute here. In the meantime, let's see what I want to play here. I will play a song that's called Walt Whitman's Ghost. Okay, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. On the web, kopn.org. And, of course, my website, mikehagan.com. All right, back in just a few minutes. This is Michael McGinty.
I'm rolling down the line. Well, I gotta keep moving, I gotta keep making time. If I sit around too long, I fear that my feet might rust. When the wheels ain't spinning, boys, they're just collecting dust. Ah, can you see the poetry in the wave of Kansas wheat? Or in the gentle rolling hills of back. Earth, 1,000 miles of sunshine on that Texas plain. In the click clack groan of a passing freight train. Yeah, I've been watching the country. I've been watching close. I've been listening for the song of old Walt Whitman's ghost. Can't see.
in the fog down on the creek. Ran across the country with a windmill hanging on. Like a land that's always changing, nothing's really ever gone. Bald knobbers in the hollers, the banjos on the breeze. There's a pounding on the ground and sounds coming from the trees. There's a fire called truth burning well into the night. When you find out you're wrong, friend, it don't really make you right. Yeah, I've been watching the country. I've been watching close. I've been listening for the song of old Walt Whitman's ghost.
Michael McGinty, Walt Whitman's Ghost. You're listening to it here on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's Mike, and it's about 5 minutes after the hour of 1 a.m. in mid-Missouri and also in Winnipeg, Manitoba, where my guest, James Michael Wilkie, is hanging out with us tonight. Jim, thanks for sticking around late into the evening.
No problem.
All right, so the headline is that the Giza Plateau and the monuments, pyramids, etc. there have a message to send, I guess, right?
Yes, and one we've been able to decipher.
And one that you have been able to decipher. We've been talking for the last hour about how that deciphering went about, or came about, I should say, and it is technical to a certain extent, and diagrams and all that stuff are very helpful to look at when we're talking about it, but I wanted people to get an idea that this was essentially a puzzle that was being solved by you all. And now let's talk a little bit about the message and what you think is going on.
Okay, but first, just one more thing.
Sure.
In the Queen's Chamber in the Great Pyramid, there's a niche on the east wall.
Okay, another one of these chunked out places or whatever. They take a little section out.
It's actually a few feet deep.
Okay.
And it's shaped like a step pyramid. Okay. Now, when you get to the end point at Hawara, and you look off to the east at Hawara, you see another pyramid. Okay.
All right.
So, again, you know, you—is that a coincidence?
Huh.
You know, and I'll leave that at that. But now, we were going to go where?
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about the message and what you think is trying to be communicated.
Okay. The entire universe expands. All right. And this message tells about periods when these expansions occur.
Okay.
Okay. We're now well into the ascension, if you will, of the planet and our sun. All right?
Okay.
In this process. Now, the process itself, basically, we should be able to relate it this way. The audience should be able to understand this. Everything in the universe works with an opposite. And the DNA model, the human DNA model.
Mm-hmm, the double helix.
Yes. Is the same model that's used throughout the universe and universes. Okay?
All right.
Where you're working with negative and positives. Okay?
All right.
Now, we've seen pictures of NASA pictures, imagery, let's say the Milky Way, and you can see the double helix there. Okay? that's just a larger helix than the helix that our sun and Jupiter, which is also a sun, create. Okay?
Now, some people are going to say, wait a minute, Jupiter's a planet.
No. Unfortunately, it's a beautiful blue, aqua blue star.
Huh.
But we can't see the aqua blue nor the size of the field because it's ahead of us in its evolutionary process. Okay? Which puts it at a different frequency.
Hmm.
And we're not at that frequency yet, therefore we don't see it. It's like almost like another dimension.
Hmm.
Okay, this field. Anyway, this creates a double helix. And that helix, like our planet right now, I don't know, I just read the other day, is no longer at a 23.5 degree tilt. It's more like 45 degrees. Okay?
45 degrees?
Yeah, I don't know what they're measuring it to. And Jupiter is also at a 45 degrees, but opposite.
Hmm.
So, as the DNA, just like the DNA when it crosses over, so too are our planets ready to make that crossover. Now, at the present time, our sun is no longer a yellow sun. All right? Because, and this is due because we were leaving a field, a frequency of light in the spectrum, which is orange. Okay?
All right.
And the pitch was basically at yellow. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, as we ascend, we have to cross neutral space, a relative zero point, because nothing touches, back into a neutral space. Now, you can remember all the work that Kent was doing on Comet Holmes, P-17 Holmes?
Sure, sure. He was very interested in that one.
Okay.
Now, that for people who don't remember, that was the one that had a tremendous outburst in October of last year and blew the mind of all the astrophysicists who and all of their cometary models, frankly, because the thing brightened by about a millionfold over the course of 24 hours or something crazy like that. And it's still, people are still watching it, I think, Jim.
Yes, they are, and rightfully so. Because I'll tell you what happened. When, see, in the way the universe works, there are these brains, B-R-A-N-E-S,
huh.
Not like human brains.
Right.
Okay, that separate these fields, okay? And inside that is a center point. Now, because from the source, from the absolute zero point, or we'll call it God, okay, geometric zero degree,
uh-huh.
This gives energy like a clear path, and this is where we get our gamma rays rushing through, okay? Because there's no resistance there, or minimal resistance. Well, Holmes passed through the brain, edge of the brain, and on October 23rd, and this is when it had an outburst that you're speaking of, which mm-hmm. was about 1 million times its size.
That's crazy.
Well, keep your eyes open because she's going to hit it again.
You think Holmes is going to brighten again?
Yes, Holmes will actually encompass our entire solar system, which will facilitate our transition through that zero point, okay, in the brain, as we leave the orange field and enter into the green field. Well, we'll enter into the neutral. Now, our sun, like I said, is no longer yellow.
Right.
Because it's now white because we're in a neutral zone.
Hmm.
Okay.
Well, there have been lots of reports. I mean, these are anecdotal, but I'm not sure if there's... Maybe you could say if there were anything been written about it, but I certainly know a lot of people and have made comments on forums and websites and discussion bulletin boards and all this stuff about observations of the sun. And people said, man, the sun looks whitish, much more white than it used to be.
Yes, and this is because we're in a neutral zone. We're entering into a new brain, okay, and crossing across it. Now, these brains, and
this is a cosmic brain of some sort, and
yes,
and it's not spelled the same as the way we spell human brain, but it's more of a celestial term.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And what happens, though, is that these brains...
That's remarkable they use that word, by the way.
Yeah, I guess so. And these brains, what they do create is, like I said, a separation between, we'll call it the width bandwidth, okay, uh-huh, in each particular field, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, and like I said, we're going from an orange field into a green field. Now, when we get into the green field, we cross over from zero, okay, so we got point one, and our sun turns to this time we'll turn to an aqua blue sun, which Jupiter is already at, okay? The egg comes first, before the chicken.
Right.
And our sun will change. Now, there will be probably a very, very short time, I don't know whether it's minutes, hours, where our sun will actually appear to turn itself off as it crosses through that relative zero point.
Well, that'd be a trip, huh?
Yeah. but
is
think
that
about
3 days of darkness or this sort of thing? Or?
Maybe. I never even equated it to that, but or even gave that thought. But the problem is, with that, is that there will be no energy between the sun and Earth. So,
and right now there's a direct connection. Both obviously people know that heat comes from the sun, but there's also an electromagnetic connection that I think people may not be that aware of.
Oh, I mean, this is what I mean. Everything is connected,
right,
in some way, and it's the frequency. Like right now, if people punch up that on the website, I put up that little paper.
Yep, I'm looking at it right now.
If you go to that EIT site, NASA site there, or LASCO.
Oh, the LASCO site. Yeah, okay. That's the first, for people who are looking at this, that's the first link on this paper. And it says LASCO, www.nrlnavy.mil/dailympeg. It's about a sixth or eighth of the way down the page.
Now, if you go to that site and you load up EIT.
And these are different filters that this SOHO LASCO telescope uses to look at the sun, for those of you who are unfamiliar, okay?
Okay, now, if you look closely, you'll see...
Which EIT?
Anyone.
Okay.
Just pick one, and it doesn't matter. I mean, it's so busy up there, you wouldn't believe. And they only show you the ones they have to show you. And the way the film, they run their film of this sequence of pictures, okay, where there's least activity, that's basically the longest period of time that these images are flashing by,
uh-huh,
that you see on the screen. So what you do is you watch it run through, and then you stick your cursor and slowly move the frame by frame back.
Uh-huh.
And what you see is just amazing.
All right, I'm gonna actually. I've got. This is from April 1st, 2008, and so you go. So you pause it, and then you go frame by frame.
No, it'll run to the end, and then you just pull it back. Put your cursor on that.
Yeah. So you put your cursor on the little scroll thing, and then just slide it back one at a time.
Very slowly. Yeah.
All right. And yeah, so you get a frame by frame type of thing.
Right. happening in less than a day.
Mm-hmm. And what should people be seeing?
Oh, you'll be seeing stuff like monstrous-sized UFOs. You'll be seeing shots being taken into the sun, shot into the sun, like beams shot into the sun. You'll also see asteroids and meteors attacking the sun and creating these sunspots. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, these sunspots, you have to view the sun as being the equivalent of the human, the female egg, and those energy bursts going into the sun as like a sperm. They're attacking this egg in an attempt to, once they get inside to the core of the sun, they will then the sun will start to transform.
Mm.
And this is what's happening. And then as we reemerge on the other side of this brain, this is where the energy and the frequency level will have, the sun will have increased it already due to this attack on it. And as these sunspots are hitting, of course, this frequency, electromagnetic frequency that we're getting here on the Earth
rises.
It's causing these huge changes in what the governments are telling everybody are caused by us burning fossil fuels.
Oh, global warming and climate change and all this business.
All the earthquakes, volcanic eruptions. I mean, the sudden increase should have, you know, trip off in people's mind. Like, why all of a sudden, boom, you know?
Mm.
What's the scientific explanation for this? And this is what it does.
So we're actually seeing something on the sun that you would equate to like a conception of sorts. Like the sun is going
yes.
to... Yes. And what's it going to give birth to?
Well...
Or is it the birth of a new sun, the birth of a new self?
Well, what it is the birth of a new sun, really. It's going to up its frequency so that it can exist in the higher frequencies. Okay, in other words, it's part of its ascension, just like, and with it, we go, right?
In other words, everything is evolving. Stars evolve, monkeys
yes.
evolve, viruses evolve, everything's evolving. And so we're reaching now a point of evolution that is critical to our star, apparently.
It's critical to our planet.
And this is and this is encoded in the Giza Plateau. This is the whole reason that we began to talk about it.
Exactly. Now, here's to show you some of the information that was encoded. The missing capstone on the Great Pyramid. Now, the Great Pyramid...
I've always really wondered about that. I've never really gotten it.
Okay.
I mean, I've never heard a story that made me go, yeah, that sounds correct.
Okay. Well, let me know what you think of this one.
Okay.
Your space, if like God created, according to Genesis, God created the heavens and earth in 6 days. On the seventh, he rested, okay?
Correct.
Well, you take six pyramids, the same as the Great Pyramid, form a cube with the apexes to the center, and you tell me what you got.
Mm.
You have a sphere in the center.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Which is the same as, you know, when we see...
Wow, okay, I get what you're saying. Explain it again spatially so people understand what you mean when you say take six of them and put them together.
Okay. If you divide space up into... cubular space. Okay, cube within cube within cube. Like the Mayans gave us that, but and Egypt as well. But the Mayans used step pyramids.
Okay.
That's because everything is interlocked. Okay? So from your four directions, you basically have five periods of ascension within a field of energy. Okay, such as the orange field.
Uh-huh.
Because you're passing 4 points. You're passing north, south, east, and west in the rotation. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you have the point of entry and exit. You see?
And so that's where...
That's where these changes occur. Now, normally, they occur... like I say, precisely at these times where these pyramids, like nothing touches in the universe. And that's the other thing about Giza that was important, is that they had casing stones on them. Now, as casing stones, in as far as increasing the outside of the pyramid,
mm-hmm.
its mass, it's at an angle of exactly pi, which is, you know, 1.4285 degrees, the angle at which they're raised up at, you see? So that's our zero space, or we'll call it one half of the brain, the neutral zone, okay?
Uh-huh.
So if you take six of these pyramids and place the base against one side of a cube and place the other identical pyramids.
Uh-huh. All right, so you have six pyramids all on the face, on the inside face of a cube pointing inward toward the center of the cube.
Exactly.
And there's six sides to a cube. So now this is very interesting to me because in Lakota tradition, in not just Lakota, but in many Native traditions, they talk about the six directions. And in other words, wherever you are, there are always six directions emanating from you. You have before you, behind you, to your left, to your right, above you, and below you, right?
Correct.
And it's sort of a definition of three-dimensional space. And what they call the seventh point is you, the center, where all of those six directions meet. And it is sort of the resting point, kind of like the way the Genesis story talks about six. Perhaps the six directions are, or the 6 days of Genesis are a description of the creation
exactly.
of three-dimensional space, and then the center point being the resting point.
Now you're getting it.
Aha, okay, so I'm with you.
Okay, so in the center there, when you've put these pyramids in place,
holy
you
God.
Get a sphere.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So, a point when all the energies are aligned create the existence of a new day, if you will, or a new life form. And it's very precise and accurate as to whether or not it will be allowed to evolve. So first we create it, it's created, and then from that point on it evolves in the system. So this is where the tie is between, or should be, between creationists and evolutionists.
Right, and intelligent design and evolution, yeah, they work pretty much together.
Now, because of the original first alignment, which we call God because it's geometric 0 degree, the point where all things started. Somewhere, now all space is basically negative space to begin with.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's negative space. There is no matter in it or...
Oh, it's empty.
But it's omnipotent because you can put the matter in there, but there just wasn't any. You see? So at one point in space, they all came together. The weight of all these different that's what gave us direction and created the growth. Now, because at that point, now, we're at the seventh point, right? Mm-hmm. So, but matter can't touch each other. So, as, let's say, the east and the west energies are headed at each other, they veer off. Now, this is what creates the spin, the rotation.
Yeah, because everything's spinning.
Right. Now,
literally.
Literally. And so then you have your other two opposite directions, because everything consists of opposites. But now we have, so you have four sides, which are giving the growth potential and spinning, okay, held in place by the top and the bottom, just like a, you know, like they're on pins, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so this is happening, all right? And this system then starts to grow, and how it does that is because of this spin. Now you've created points close to that where energy then starts to accumulate because of empty space.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And you start giving it absolute direction. And then from there, everything grows. Now, people say, well, what about Hawking and his Big Bang Theory? Huh. Right?
Right?
Well, it's not a Big Bang so much as it's just an outward growth.
Yeah, yeah, just it's more organic.
Yeah.
Huh?
Exactly, and speaking of organic versus the universe, I just happened to glimpse a small article on this guy that had, was studying and spliced got a cross-section of a rat's brain, and the university, I guess, that he's working at, had just finished or has a model, computer-generated model, of everything we know and created a universe, and they're identical.
Hmm.
So the process is identical.
Unbelievable. All right, good place to take another little break, okay?
All righty.
All right, we will have about a three-minute break, everybody. We'll come back with James Michael Wilkie on the web once again at firstborn.ca, and we will have about 20 minutes or so to sort of put it all together. Okay, James?
Sure.
All right, everybody. Once again, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, and we got another piece of music here from Michael McGinty. This one is called Good God, and you can check this out on the web as well. After the program is finished, I'll get this show up in the archives, and you can also go to the music archives and see a little bit about the music you're hearing tonight, okay? Also, Ruth will be in about 30 minutes to crash land and play some wonderful music for you for the next few hours, so stick around, okay? All right, Mike Hagan, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, it's Radio Orbit.
River looking muddy and mean, sea cover New Orleans. Mississippi River looking muddy and mean, loneliest damn thing I ever did see. Don't you hang your head in sorrow, come what may. Don't you hang your head in sorrow, dry your tears for the falling rain. Ain't no Zydeco on the street no more, the silence like a raging horn. Ain't no Zydeco on the street no more, the sound got drowned in the howling storm. Don't you hang your head in sorrow, come what may. Don't you hang your head in sorrow, dry your tears for the falling rain. Listen to me, brother, won't you lend your hand? Be more than just a bag of sand. Listen to me, sister, won't you lend that hand? The levee crashing, broken down dam. Don't you hang your head in sorrow, come what may. Don't you hang your head in sorrow,
dry your tears for the falling rain. People are too strong to stick down too long. The cry will have to turn to song. People too strong to stay down too long. Turn your eyes to the coming dawn. Don't you hang your head in sorrow, come what may. Don't you hang your head in sorrow, dry your tears for the falling rain. Mississippi River looking muddy and mean, the sea covered New Orleans. Mississippi River looking muddy and mean, loneliest damn thing you ever did to me. Don't you hang your head in sorrow, come what may. Don't you hang your head in sorrow, dry your tears for the falling rain.
Michael McGinty, once again, that one's called Good God. How about it? All right. 1:35 in the a.m. on now the 3rd of June, 2008. James Michael Wilkie on the line with us from Winnipeg, Manitoba for the last hour and a half. Thanks again to James for sticking around late into the night, and we will get right back to him here and say hello after I mention the website really quickly one more time, firstborn.ca. And that website will be expanding in the near future, I imagine. Is that right, James?
Oh, it's like I said, we just decided to put up a separate website this morning, and that's what we put up so far.
Okay. All right. So we are in the middle of crunch time with regard to evolutionary processes, not only not only in ourselves, but the planet, the sun, the whole universe, apparently. Please just continue along the lines and let us know what to expect, maybe, in your opinion.
Well, okay, now let's make a little tie between universal growth that the Mayans and the Egyptians were giving us here. Now, remember, a standard pyramid on its inside basically consists of, like I say, 5 levels. All right, that's the point you cross zero, etc. The point you exit the brain, which is the lead-off area from the frequency. Now, these frequencies are also, and space being cubed from this energy, we have a complex matrix which gives us mass and everything as these frequencies cross and interlock with each other, and et cetera, et cetera. Now, the only problem that you can run into in the system is perfect is when somebody tries to alter the system or remove or bend space. And I think that's what happened to Mars. They reached a technological level where they thought they could control without understanding. But to even mess with it, it was wrong, but anyway. Mm. And they did bend space. And as a result of that, that planet is now, or has been, dying. And it may or may not, and I tend to believe it won't, make this next ascension, because we're entering into a whole new field. Now, whether there were survivors and they found their way here to our world, because they had the technology, I mean, some might think that to call them the Greys or whatever, because if these people are here, that means we can't see them anyway, because they're in a different night frequency.
Mm. A listener asks about pyramids on Mars.
Yes.
You know, that's one of the things that Richard Hoagland has investigated quite a bit, but I'm sure other people as well.
Yes, I once spent some time with Hoagland in his place, just in Hoboken or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
before he moved. But anyway, yeah, that. But if you notice, the pyramids on Mars were five-sided.
Yeah, they're pentagonal pyramids, yeah.
Yes, and now that just shows you the mentality there. They didn't go with the, you know, the universal system. They opted to try to create a new one. And if you go into the Bible, maybe you want to relate it as, you know, the Pharaoh lays down the snake, his scientists and his advisors lay down this snake, and Moses lays down his staff,
and it turns
devours the other.
Yeah.
You see? Because you can't support two systems. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, on June the 8th, of this year, in other words, in 5 days, an alignment takes place, and strangely enough, it's called the Orange Alignment.
Hmm.
All right. Now, during that time, Mars, all the planets are in alignment except for Mars, which is just way, way out of alignment, almost at a right angle. That could have been caused by what they did to bend space last time. All right? And if you wonder why it's a red planet, I might theorize that the core of the planet just can't handle the changes that were in when it jumped out at the fourth stage. Couldn't handle it, and it started to complicate it within itself.
Hmm. You know, Mars looks like it has expanded because the surface is torn apart. You know, it looks like it has big rifts that,
yes.
You know, like maybe it was smaller before, otherwise you wouldn't have these huge, gigantic caverns and stuff on the surface. And I know there are other arguments for how the Martian surface got to be the way that it is, but...
Well, I think our asteroid belt's just going to be a little bit larger.
You think Mars is going to explode?
Yes, but it will explode before 2012.
Will it be something that occurs in our frequency that we'll be able to witness?
Yes.
Holy cow, that'll be some fireworks.
You bet. But anyway...
Well, okay, so continue along. Well, we got 15 minutes. I mean, it's getting more interesting here.
Okay. We have what we know, and most people know anyway, is chemtrails. They've been chemtrailing for years now.
Yep, I've been paying attention since 1998, and
yeah,
I'm not sure what they're doing it for, but...
Now, these chemtrails contain such things as aluminum, barium...
Barium, all kinds of metals, yes.
All right. Now, this secret government, okay, has always used compartmentalized system.
Yes.
All right. So one doesn't know what the other one's doing. Now, the reason they're chemtrailing is to... deflect
incoming radiation. Incoming radiation?
Well, the magnetic field and the radiation, yeah.
From the sun?
From the sun.
Okay, because that's increasing as we've been talking about.
Yes, but we should be increasing with it.
Uh-huh.
But now they're cutting it off because they can't exist in that increase. Okay, so now... That's step one. The other step is now they're going to fire up CERN.
Yeah, they're in the process of it right now. I mean, literally.
Yes. Now, here's what's wrong with that. It's not the black holes we have to worry about. Because when these protons get up to speed and they fire protons the other way, and they collide, they send out little shock waves. Now, we're sending hundreds of thousands of these out, all right?
Mm.
And they're, you know, it's an energy wave. It's a sound wave.
Yeah, yeah.
We just can't see it. Now, because of the chem spray, chemtrailing, and not only will it reflect what's coming in from the sun and help it bend space. There, now, it's going to be holding these things, these sound waves in, and they're just going to amplify.
So it's reflecting these back and the other ones out.
Yes.
Mm. What do you think the effect of that's going to be?
Well, they're hoping to bend space and, in other words, put us in the same predicament
that Mars was
that
in.
That Mars was in.
So in other words, you believe that there's actually an intent to do that at CERN?
Yes, but I don't think that...
Do you think they know it?
I don't think the scientists involved at CERN necessarily
Because of the compartmentalization that you were talking about.
Exactly. But this is inevitable now. Unless, of course, the scientists get a hold, and I would encourage people to send, you know, emails to whoever, any of the scientists, and bring it forward, because I know that it's definitely going to interfere and bend space. Now, if we want to evolve as a race, then I think we, you know, we could do that. But more
and the result, if they were successful in this attempt, would be essentially to keep things the way they are, and sort of stump evolution.
Well, you're familiar with the Red Sky Prophecy.
I am.
Well, that's what the Red Sky Prophecy speaks of.
For those who don't know, tell a quick summary of it.
Well, basically, what's his last name? Brown? Anyway, this elder native, an elder, he had these prophecies or these visions. And the vision spoke of this red sky. And he was shown that there are options. And if man doesn't change its way, and we do something about it, eventually the sky will turn red. It'll just crack itself open. It'll look like it's cracking. And I mean, there's dolphins and everything floating up there and everything. So, I mean, it's very severe. But we don't have to let that happen, is basically what the prophecy is all about.
Yeah, and it was, I think it was Tom Brown. I think you're right, Les, it was Brown. Tom Brown.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that doesn't, that's, to me, that's not an important thing, because I know that it's the individual soul that's important. So I worry about my soul first, and then anything I can do after that to help mankind is okay too, you know, or do them at the same time. But
well, what does this mean for most human beings, and you know, in other words, and okay, so we have 2012, December 21st as sort of a deadline, so to speak. Maybe that's not a very good choice of words, but so the idea is that between now and then, these things
will have happened,
and then I guess it's just a matter of, what do you think will be happening with human beings? I mean, if there's evolution going on, and we've been talking about it happening on a grander scale, there will be evolution happening among human beings as well, or they will, human beings, some of them perhaps, maybe not all, evolution seems to not always allow everyone to go forward, but will some people change and become no longer human, or a different type of human or something?
Well, they'll literally be stuck in hell. And because there's no way out. You see, once you miss a step in the evolutionary process, you can't just step back in. You know? And this is why, now that we're moving fields, never mind the ascension within a field, those three other points I was talking about, never mind that one, but if you miss a whole field, yeah, there ain't no way in hell you're going to be able to make that up, because the universe keeps growing.
So,
I think, myself, I'm going to use a lot of, or not a lot of, I'm going to use colloidal silver for the following reason, is that silver is a great conductor. Now, our human body, okay, the bone structure, look at the bone structure as being brains, all right?
Okay.
So they carry the vibration from the heart through these, I picked up, like our chest cavity is like a big tuning fork, all right? And because of the aerial spraying and the filtering, we have to be able to individually jack up our frequency or make use of every bit that's coming through to us.
Right, I understand.
And in order to do that, I decided that maybe I'll use colloidal silver, which is a conductor, a very good one, to up that, help it out.
Yeah, and some very interesting medicinal benefits as well, perhaps, if you've got a good product and or you know how to make this stuff correctly.
Well, the medicinal products are because your body will then be working at a proper frequency.
Right, I understand, yeah.
If you notice, I mean, Alzheimer's is on the increase. We have all these new viruses coming in. These are coming in because our system isn't keeping up with it. Because of the aerial spray.
Right, we've been suppressed, repressed the whole bit.
You bet.
Well, I certainly agree with you there, and I've been very interested in silver for quite some time as well, for similar and also some different reasons. But it's I believe that it is that it's important to the future in some way, shape, or form. I haven't quite put my finger on it, but I find the whole subject amazing, and the fact that you relate it to an electromagnetic phenomenon, like a vibrational increase, this sort of thing, a frequency shift, that's something that I had not particularly considered. I think it's really interesting.
Well, I mean, if you look at Carillion photography,
yeah,
and you see the aura. And
tell people what that is. A lot of people may not be familiar. That's something that Tompkins was very instrumental in showing me, at least.
It's like the electromagnetic field that extends out of the body. And certain cameras can pick it up, and it's in color. Now, this extends out 3 feet. It extends out 3 feet into the ground, above your head, to your side.
Right, the six directions like we were talking
yes.
about.
Now, if there's something wrong with a particular part of the body, it will alter the color. It'll show up on Carillion photography.
Mm.
Now, you start to be able to associate these colors with different frequencies, and you can tell which ones are good, which ones are bad for you, where the problems lie, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
By reading these things. So, I mean, if you're looking how this all works, you have to start thinking about color and the light spectrum versus harmonics and frequencies and vibrations.
Well, let me ask you this, since we only have a few minutes left. It seems to me that very few people are even considering ideas like this, much less believing in them. And I mean in a general sense across this entire planet. Do you think that that is significant in who might make it and who might not? I mean, in one way or the other? Or what do you make of the fact that very few people are tuned in? And I mean this, you know, not just in your work, but this in a general sense, I mean it with many of the topics that are discussed on this program. But this is a big one, and it's one that's interesting.
Yes, well, the thing is until I would encourage people to start following that website every once in a while, check in, or we'll probably go to a newsletter or something.
Okay.
As segments are done, because it's going to be fast and quick. And in the interim, we have to be able to use animations and a lot of diagrams and photos, etc., and without being able to see this. But I think once people get a little grasp on it, this thing will, because it just makes too much sense, you know, and consistent. It's consistent throughout, and it answers a lot of questions. And even if it people agree or not agree, that's freedom of choice, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
You know, and isn't that what it's about? You either choose to go forward, or you choose to be scared and let fear into yourself, which changes your vibration.
Mm-hmm.
You see? I mean, there's nothing... We can only... Each person is an individual universe. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Just like a rat's brain.
Yeah, but it's... And then, you know, you just keep getting bigger and bigger DNAs, you know? Mm-hmm. Astronauts are reported seeing angels outside the craft 50 feet tall.
Yeah, huge. I mean, this is for real. The Russian cosmonauts reported literally angelic beings that were floating through space. This didn't get any press here in the U.S., but the Russians are pretty interesting folk. I wish we had more time to talk about them, but they're a little bit more forthcoming, at least they used to be, about some of these ideas. But, in fact, Karelian photography, I think, evolved over there, perhaps. At any rate, well, last words, Jim, with regard to tonight's program, at least.
Well, I'm happy to be on the show and be able to share some information. If we tweak anything in anybody's mind that creates thought into a matter, then we've done a good job.
We did a good job. All right. Well, I think that's a great place to finish up then, all right?
You betcha.
It's been a pleasure. James Michael Wilkie, thanks so much for being on the program. And once again, firstborn.ca, people, keep your eye on that website. There'll be some additional information certainly showing up there very shortly. Wow.
Okay, Mike.
Jim, thanks a lot. Take care of yourself. Have a great evening, okay?
You too.
All right, bye-bye. All right, everybody. James Michael Wilkie, thanks so much. Once again, firstborn.ca on the web, okay? All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My good friend Ruth about to step in and play some tunes for y'all. I will say goodnight, and thanks for listening to the program. Come on back next week. We will have Samir Osmaganich, and we will talk about pyramids in Bosnia, perhaps. And I wonder if Jim's still on the line. James, you still there? Nope, he hung up. I was going to ask him if he heard anything about that Bosnian situation. So, at any rate, we will do it up again next week, okay? And in the meantime, enjoy yourselves, take care, and we'll talk to you next week, okay? Once again, this is Michael McGinty, and the song is called Where I'm Bound, and I'm bound home. And Ruthie's bound to play some good tunes for you in just a few minutes, okay? Take care of yourselves. It's been Mike, Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia.
There's a farmer in a field. He's praying for rain. There's a boy out on the roadside, he's praying for the same. And I'd pray for anything, if it would ease this pain. I don't know where I'm bound, but I'm bound to be on my way. As they are changing, I think it just might rain. From the things that I've been thinking, Lord, I just cannot get away. And this loneliness lingers,
like a fog across the bay. I don't know where I'm bound, but I'm bound to be on my way. I don't know.